of observations now seem to me hopeless. The operations and measurements that a scientist undertakes in the laboratory are not the given of experience, but rather the collected with difficulty. They are not what the scientist sees, at least not before his research is well advanced and his attention focused. Rather, they are concrete indices to the content of more elementary perceptions, and as such, they are selected for the close scrutiny of normal research only because they promise opportunity for the fruitful elaboration of an accepted paradigm. Far more clearly than the immediate experience from which they in part derive, operations and measurements are paradigm determined. Science does not deal in all possible laboratory manipulations. Instead, it selects those relevant to the juxtaposition of a paradigm, with the immediate experience that that paradigm has partially determined. As a result, scientists with different paradigms engage in different concrete laboratory manipulations. The measurements to be performed on a pendulum are not the ones relevant to a case of constrained fall, nor are the operations relevant for the elucidation of oxygen's properties, uniformly the same as those required when investigating the characteristics of dephlogisticated air. As for a pure observation language, perhaps one will yet be devised. But 3 centuries after Descartes, our hope for such an eventuality still depends exclusively upon a theory of perception and of the mind. And modern psychological experimentation is rapidly proliferating phenomena with which that theory can scarcely deal. The duck-rabbit shows that 2 men with the same retinal impressions can see different things. The inverting lenses show that 2 men with different retinal impressions can see the same thing. Psychology supplies a great deal of other evidence to the same effect, and the doubts that derive from it are readily reinforced by the history of attempts to exhibit an actual language of observation. No current attempt to achieve that end has yet come close to a generally applicable language of pure percepts. And those attempts that come closest share one characteristic that strongly reinforces several of this essay's main theses. From the start, they presuppose a paradigm, taken either from a current scientific theory or from some fraction of everyday discourse, and they then try to eliminate from it all non-logical and non-perceptual terms. In a few realms of discourse, this effort has been carried very far, and with fascinating results. There can be no question that efforts of this sort are worth pursuing. But their result is a language that, like those employed in the sciences, embodies a host of expectations about nature and fails to function the moment these expectations are violated. Nelson Goodman makes exactly this point in describing the aims of his structure of appearance. It is fortunate that nothing more than phenomena known to exist is in question, for the notion of possible cases, of cases that do not exist but might have existed, is far from clear. No language thus restricted to reporting a world fully known in advance can produce mere neutral and objective reports on the given. Philosophical investigation has not yet provided even a hint of what a language able to do that would be like. Under these circumstances, we may at least suspect that scientists are right in principle, as well as in practice, when they treat oxygen and pendulums, and perhaps also atoms and electrons, as the fundamental ingredients of their immediate experience. As a result of the paradigm-embodied experience of the race, the culture, and finally the profession, the world of the scientist has come to be populated with planets and pendulums, condensers and compound ores, and other such bodies besides. Compared with these objects of perception, both meter stick readings and retinal imprints are elaborate constructs, to which experience has direct access only when the scientist, for the special purposes of his research, arranges that one or the other should do so. This is not to suggest that pendulums, for example, are the only things a scientist could possibly see when looking at a swinging stone. We have already noted that members of another scientific community could see constrained fall. But it is to suggest that the scientist who looks at a swinging stone can have no experience that is, in principle, more elementary than seeing a pendulum. The alternative is not some hypothetical fixed vision, but vision through another paradigm, one which makes the swinging stone something else. All of this may seem more reasonable if we again remember that neither scientists nor laymen learn to see the world piecemeal, or item by item. Except when all the conceptual and manipulative categories are prepared in advance, e.g. for the discovery of an additional transuranic element, or for catching sight of a new house, both scientists and laymen sort out whole areas together from the flux of experience. The child who transfers the word mama from all humans to all females, and then to his mother, is not just learning what mama means or who his mother is. Simultaneously, he is learning some of the differences between males and females, as well as something about the ways in which all but one female will behave toward him. His reactions, expectations, and beliefs, indeed, much of his perceived world, change accordingly. By the same token, the Copernicans who denied its traditional title planet to the sun were not only learning what planet meant or what the sun was. Instead, they were changing the meaning of planet so that it could continue to make useful distinctions in a world where all celestial bodies, not just the sun, were seen differently from the way they had been seen before. The same point could be made about any of our earlier examples. To see oxygen instead of dephlogisticated air, the condenser instead of the Leyden jar, or the pendulum instead of constrained fall, was only one part of an integrated shift in the scientist's vision of a great many related chemical, electrical, or dynamical phenomena. Paradigms determine large areas of experience at the same time. It is, however, only after experience has been thus determined that the search for an operational definition or a pure observation language can begin. The scientist or philosopher who asks what measurements or retinal imprints make the pendulum what it is must already be able to recognize a pendulum when he sees one. If he saw constrained fall instead, his question could not even be asked. And if he saw a pendulum, but saw it in the same way he saw a tuning fork or an oscillating balance, his question could not be answered. At least it could not be answered in the same way, because it would not be the same question. Therefore, though they are always legitimate and are occasionally extraordinarily fruitful, questions about retinal imprints, or about the consequences of particular laboratory manipulations, presuppose a world already perceptually and conceptually subdivided in a certain way. In a sense, such questions are parts of normal science, for they depend upon the existence of a paradigm, and they receive different answers as a result of paradigm change. To conclude this section, let us henceforth neglect retinal impressions and again restrict attention to the laboratory operations that provide the scientist with concrete, though fragmentary, indices to what he has already seen. One way in which such laboratory operations change with paradigms has already been observed repeatedly. After a scientific revolution, many old measurements and manipulations become irrelevant and are replaced by others instead. One does not apply all the same tests to oxygen as to dephlogisticated air. But changes of this sort are never total. Whatever he may then see, the scientist after a revolution is still looking at the same world. Furthermore, though he may previously have employed them differently, much of his language, and most of his laboratory instruments, are still the same as they were before. As a result, post-revolutionary science invariably includes many of the same manipulations, performed with the same instruments and described in the same terms, as its pre-revolutionary predecessor. If these enduring manipulations have been changed at all, the change must lie either in their relation to the paradigm or in their concrete results. I now suggest, by the introduction of one last new example, that both these sorts of changes occur. Examining the work of Dalton and his contemporaries, we shall discover that one and the same operation, when it attaches to nature through a different paradigm, can become an index to a quite different aspect of nature's regularity. In addition, we shall see that occasionally, the old manipulation, in its new role, will yield different, concrete results. Throughout much of the 18th century and into the 19th, European chemists almost universally believed that the elementary atoms of which all chemical species consisted were held together by forces of mutual affinity. Thus, a lump of silver cohered because of the forces of affinity between silver corpuscles, until after Lavoisier, these corpuscles were themselves thought of as compounded from still more elementary particles. On the same theory, silver dissolved in acid, or salt in water, because the particles of acid attracted those of silver, or the particles of water attracted those of salt, more strongly than particles of these solutes attracted each other. Or again, copper would dissolve in the silver solution and precipitate silver because the copper-acid affinity was greater than the affinity of acid for silver. A great many other phenomena were explained in the same way. In the 18th century, the theory of elective affinity was an admirable chemical paradigm, widely and sometimes fruitfully deployed in the design and analysis of chemical experimentation. Affinity theory, however, drew the line separating physical mixtures from chemical compounds in a way that has become unfamiliar since the assimilation of Dalton's work. 18th century chemists did recognize two sorts of processes. When mixing produced heat, light, effervescence, or something else of the sort, chemical union was seen to have taken place. If, on the other hand, the particles in the mixture could be distinguished by eye, or mechanically separated, there was only physical mixture. But in the very large number of intermediate cases, salt in water, alloys, glass, oxygen in the atmosphere, and so on, these crude criteria were of little use. Guided by their paradigm, most chemists viewed this entire intermediate range as chemical, because the processes of which it consisted were all governed by forces of the same sort. Salt in water, or oxygen in nitrogen, was just as much an example of chemical combination as was the combination produced by oxidizing copper. The arguments for viewing solutions as compounds were very strong. Affinity theory itself was well attested. Besides, the formation of a compound accounted for a solution's observed homogeneity. If, for example, oxygen and nitrogen were only mixed and not combined in the atmosphere, then the heavier gas, oxygen, should settle to the bottom. Dalton, who took the atmosphere to be a mixture, was never satisfactorily able to explain oxygen's failure to do so. The assimilation of his atomic theory ultimately created an anomaly where there had been none before. One is tempted to say that the chemists who viewed solutions as compounds differed from their successors only over a matter of definition. In one sense, that may have been the case, but that sense is not the one that makes definitions mere conventional conveniences. In the 18th century, Mixtures were not fully distinguished from compounds by operational tests, and perhaps they could not have been. Even if chemists had looked for such tests, they would have sought criteria that made the solution a compound. The mixture-compound distinction was part of their paradigm, part of the way they viewed their whole field of research. And as such, it was prior to any particular laboratory test, though not to the accumulated experience of chemistry as a whole. But while chemistry was viewed in this way, chemical phenomena exemplified laws different from those that emerged with the assimilation of Dalton's new paradigm. In particular, while solutions remained compounds, no amount of chemical experimentation could by itself have produced the law of fixed proportions. At the end of the 18th century, it was widely known that some compounds ordinarily contained fixed proportions by weight of their constituents. For some categories of reactions, the German chemist Richter had even noted the further regularities now embraced by the law of chemical equivalence. But no chemist made use of these regularities, except in recipes, and no one until almost the end of the century thought of generalizing them. Given the obvious counterinstances, like glass or like salt in water, no generalization was possible without an abandonment of affinity theory and a reconceptualization of the boundaries of the chemist's domain. That consequence became explicit at the very end of the century, in a famous debate between the French chemists Proust and Berthollet. The first claimed that all chemical reactions occurred in fixed proportion, the latter that they did not. Each collected impressive experimental evidence for his view. Nevertheless, the two men necessarily talked through each other, and their debate was entirely inconclusive. Where Berthollet saw a compound that could vary in proportion, Proust saw only a physical mixture. To that issue, neither experiment nor a change of definitional convention could be relevant. The two men were as fundamentally at cross purposes as Galileo and Aristotle had been. This was the situation during the years when John Dalton undertook the investigations that led, finally, to his famous chemical atomic theory. But until the very last stages of those investigations, Dalton was neither a chemist nor interested in chemistry. Instead, he was a meteorologist, investigating the, for him, physical problems of the absorption of gases by water and of water by the atmosphere. Partly because his training was in a different specialty, and partly because of his own work in that specialty, he approached these problems with a paradigm different from that of contemporary chemists. In particular, he viewed the mixture of gases, or the absorption of a gas in water, as a physical process, one in which forces of affinity played no part. To him, therefore, the observed homogeneity of solutions was a problem, but one which he thought he could solve if he could determine the relative sizes and weights of the various atomic particles in his experimental mixtures. It was to determine these sizes and weights that Dalton finally turned to chemistry, supposing from the start that, in the restricted range of reactions that he took to be chemical, atoms could only combine one-to-one, or in some other simple whole-number ratio. That natural assumption did enable him to determine the sizes and weights of elementary particles, but it also made the law of constant proportion a tautology. For Dalton, any reaction in which the ingredients did not enter in fixed proportion was ipso facto not a purely chemical process. A law that experiment could not have established before Dalton's work became, once that work was accepted, a constitutive principle that no single set of chemical measurements could have upset. As a result of what is perhaps our fullest example of a scientific revolution, the same chemical manipulations assumed a relationship to chemical generalization very different from the one they had had before. Needless to say, Dalton's conclusions were widely attacked when first announced. Berthollet, in particular, was never convinced. Considering the nature of the issue, he need not have been. But to most chemists, Dalton's new paradigm proved convincing where Proust's had not been, for it had implications far wider and more important than a new criterion for distinguishing a mixture from a compound. If, for example, atoms could combine chemically only in simple whole number ratios, then a re-examination of existing chemical data should disclose examples of multiple as well as of fixed proportions. Chemists stopped writing that the two oxides of, say, carbon contained 56% and 72% of oxygen by weight. Instead, they wrote that 1 weight of carbon would combine either with 1.3 or with 2.6 weights of oxygen. When the results of old manipulations were recorded in this way, a 2-to-1 ratio leaped to the eye. And this occurred in the analysis of many well-known reactions and of new ones besides. In addition, Dalton's paradigm made it possible to assimilate Richter's work and to see its full generality. Also, it suggested new experiments, particularly those of Gay-Lussac on combining volumes. And these yielded still other regularities, ones that chemists had not previously dreamed of. What chemists took from Dalton was not new experimental laws, but a new way of practicing chemistry. He himself called it the new system of chemical philosophy. And this proved so rapidly fruitful that only a few of the older chemists in France and Britain were able to resist it. As a result, chemists came to live in a world where reactions behaved quite differently from the way they had before. As all this went on, one other typical and very important change occurred. Here and there, the very numerical data of chemistry began to shift. When Dalton first searched the chemical literature for data to support his physical theory, he found some records of reactions that fitted, but he can scarcely have avoided finding others that did not. Proust's own measurements on the two oxides of copper yielded, for example, an oxygen weight ratio of 1.47 to 1, rather than the 2 to 1 demanded by the atomic theory. And Proust is just the man who might have been expected to achieve the Daltonian ratio. He was, that is, a fine experimentalist. And his view of the relation between mixtures and compounds was very close to Dalton's. But it is hard to make nature fit a paradigm. That is why the puzzles of normal science are so challenging, and also why measurements undertaken without a paradigm so seldom lead to any conclusions at all. Chemists could not, therefore, simply accept Dalton's theory on the evidence, for much of that was still negative. Instead, even after accepting the theory, they had still to beat nature into line, a process which, in the event, took almost another generation. When it was done, even the percentage composition of well-known compounds was different. The data themselves had changed. That is the last of the senses in which we may want to say that, after a revolution, scientists work in a different world. Chapter 11. The Invisibility of Revolutions. We must still ask how scientific revolutions close. Before doing so, however, a last attempt to reinforce conviction about their existence and nature seems called for. I have so far tried to display revolutions by illustration, and the examples could be multiplied ad nauseam. But clearly, most of them, which were deliberately selected for their familiarity, have customarily been viewed not as revolutions, but as additions to scientific knowledge. That same view could equally well be taken of any additional illustrations, and these would probably be ineffective. I suggest that there are excellent reasons why revolutions have proved to be so nearly invisible. Both scientists and laymen take much of their image of creative scientific activity from an authoritative source that systematically disguises, partly for important functional reasons, the existence and significance of scientific revolutions. Only when the nature of that authority is recognized and analyzed can one hope to make historical example fully effective. Furthermore, though the point can be fully developed only in my concluding section, the analysis now required will begin to indicate one of the aspects of scientific work that most clearly distinguishes it from every other creative pursuit except perhaps theology. As the source of authority, I have in mind principally textbooks of science, together with both the popularizations and the philosophical works modeled on them. All three of these categories, until recently, no other significant sources of information about science have been available except through the practice of research, have one thing in common. They address themselves to an already articulated body of problems, data, and theory, most often to the particular set of paradigms to which the scientific community is committed at the time they are written. Textbooks themselves aim to communicate the vocabulary and syntax of a contemporary scientific language. Popularizations attempt to describe these same applications in a language closer to that of everyday life. And philosophy of science, particularly that of the English-speaking world, analyzes the logical structure of the same completed body of scientific knowledge. Though a fuller treatment would necessarily deal with the very real distinctions between these three genres, it is their similarities that most concern us here. All three record the stable outcome of past revolutions, and thus display the bases of the current normal scientific tradition. To fulfill their function, they need not provide authentic information about the way in which those bases were first recognized and then embraced by the profession. In the case of textbooks, at least, there are even good reasons why, in these matters, they should be systematically misleading. We noted in Section 2 that an increasing reliance on textbooks, or their equivalent, was an invariable concomitant of the emergence of a first paradigm in any field of science. The concluding section of this essay will argue that the domination of a mature science by such texts significantly differentiates its developmental pattern from that of other fields. For the moment, let us simply take it for granted that, to an extent unprecedented in other fields, both the layman's and the practitioner's knowledge of science is based on textbooks and a few other types of literature derived from them. Textbooks, however, being pedagogic vehicles for the perpetuation of normal science, have to be rewritten, in whole or in part, whenever the language, problem structure, or standards of normal science change. In short, they have to be rewritten in the aftermath of each scientific revolution. And once rewritten, they inevitably disguise not only the role, but the very existence of the revolutions that produced them. Unless he has personally experienced a revolution in his own lifetime, the historical sense either of the working scientist or of the lay reader of textbook literature extends only to the outcome of the most recent revolutions in the field. Textbooks thus begin by truncating the scientist's sense of his discipline's history, and then proceed to supply a substitute for what they have eliminated. Characteristically, textbooks of science contain just a bit of history, either in an introductory chapter or, more often, in scattered references to the great heroes of an earlier age. From such references, both students and professionals come to feel like participants in a long-standing historical tradition. Yet the textbook-derived tradition, in which scientists come to sense their participation, is one that, in fact, never existed. For reasons that are both obvious and highly functional, science textbooks, and too many of the older histories of science, refer only to that part of the work of past scientists that can easily be viewed as contributions to the statement and solution of the text.